You are tuned into CKLN 88.1 FM, and we are in the studio tonight talking about healing from trauma with Fran Tabobendong, Lucy Costa, and Michelle Millard. And we have a caller on the line. I think it's Don Weitz. Don.
Yes, you certainly do. Anyway, listen, I want to say a lot of good congratulations, and you have my total support and respect for doing this, talking about healing, especially in a non-medical, non-psychiatric mode. So that's really important, because so many people that I'm sure I've run into, and Lucy and others, when they are going through emotional pain, the first thing they think of, unfortunately, is seeing a shrink or getting psychiatric help, which is, I believe, the last thing that people need. But I just wanted to add this. Have you talked yet about a safe house, a women's safe house, which I think we're in desperate need here in Toronto and elsewhere across Canada, you know, where healing can be done, a lot of peer self-help counseling. So I just wondered whether this is an important enough issue for you to talk about, run by four women who are going through, you know, a lot of serious trauma. But I haven't heard of any such safe house in Toronto, but there may well be. So I just thought I'd throw that out.
Thanks, Don. Yeah, I don't think we haven't talked about that, and I don't think such a place really exists in Toronto at the moment.
I don't think so either. Like,
yeah, it's time, right?
Yeah, it is time, and you sent a wonderful email out.
Get it.
Yes, in regards to Irit Shimrat, who's a sex survivor from Vancouver, who's organizing out west to lobby government for funding to create a safe house for women where they're free from being labeled and psychiatrized. But as you know, and many of our listeners probably know, the government's not too keen on funding something where they're not going to receive a profit back.
Yeah, I know
or control
that.
Over it anyway.
Well, it's something I think that maybe some women's groups can organize around, because it seems to be such a crying need. And God knows we've had enough oppression from male shrinks to last 1,000 lifetimes. We don't need them, and we have to create our own spaces and houses. So, you know, I certainly support that, and other safe houses, which we desperately need. So when Irit Shimrat, who's a good friend, sent that to me, sent her report, and I have her full report, which I'd be glad to share, from last June. I just emailed an excerpt, you know, her conclusion. But, yeah, so just let me know, and I'll be glad to share the report, okay? And happy Women's Week.
Thanks, Don.
International Women's Week.
If you're still there, Don, can you give the number for the People Against Coercive Treatment? I don't have it handy.
Yeah, you want to know?
Yeah.
Sure, okay, it's 416-760-2795. That's 760-2795, and... you know, if anybody feels that they want to connect with us, you know, we're a political action group, and we try to give out some decent information and hook people up with non-coercive, non-psychiatric sources of help, okay?
Okay, thanks, Don.
Yeah.
The number to call again is 416-595-1655. Michelle had something she wanted to say.
Two things. One is, on a personal level, I think women should organize an underground railroad for each other, and I don't know why that's not being done. The other thing is, not all psychiatrists are power-hungry, authoritarian figures. I'd say this in defense of our network, our health network. We have psychologists and psychiatrists and GPs who have done amazing work, just incredible work. As with all professions, all organizations, all communities, you have the really bad end of the spectrum, and then you have wonderful ends. Some of it is systemic, of course. Actually, a lot of it is systemic. What you see in how some institutions relate to with their clientele, I'm sure you can see reflected in the larger society around. So it's never done in a vacuum, and it's done with permission, right? Having said that, you know, there are some good doctors out there, and I've seen the results, and That's all I have to say.
Okay, here we go. I agree with you. There are great, lovely people all over the world. However, yeah. I think we need to allow space yeah. to, and just to let it be that there are actually a lot of people that have been hurt, and that a lot of, and shrinks suck. I think we just need space to say psychiatry sucks, shrinks sucks, and they get money, lots of money, to do what they do. Mm-hmm. And I just want to be able to have the space to say that and not be told, like, hey, they're not all bad. I know they're not all bad. Mm-hmm. I don't give a shit. We're talking about huge political issues here, and I want to be able to. That's the whole point, is that we're not allowed the space to do that.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. You know, I'm just I just got triggered because, but also like I was thinking about this earlier. You know, the notion of healing implies that there's also illness, and that, as you say, mm-hmm. that's not necessarily true. I was also thinking in terms of what happens with some of the documentation of survivors of torture, because medicalization of symptoms seems to be one of the only ways we in the West recognize that suffering has taken place. And certainly I think, you know, of course PTSD exists, of course diagnoses exist, but how it exists, I think, has to be taken, a good look has to be taken at it. You know, we don't recognize suffering in our culture mm-hmm. other than as something abnormal.
That's key, sorry, Fred, but that's key, that we don't recognize suffering. And the world is in, I like to think of myself an idealist, but I guess I'm not. Like, the world is in such a state right now that where are we allowing space to discuss that and have room for that?
Well, the thing I wanted to mention was that on the First Nations, we've been told what all our problems are, and by non-Aboriginals, professionals who have come into our communities, mm-hmm. and we realize that we're the experts. Mm-hmm. We know how to. We're gonna do what we need to do to help ourselves, and we have our own ways, and those traditional ways, like I mentioned before, are coming back, and we're utilizing them, and they're helping our people, and they're helping us to heal, and improving our quality of life.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that will bring us to a question that we wanted to ask about how this work, this healing work, and I stand by using healing, because I think it does not only necessarily imply illness, I think it implies injury. Mm-hmm. So I think it's in that the way that that's at least the way that I'm using it, because I don't see myself as someone who is sick, but someone who has, you know, experienced some injury. And I agree that that the society doesn't recognize suffering, you know, except as something that is somehow abnormal. And we were talking about that earlier, and sort of deconstructing that notion of what is normal. And I think it is perfectly normal to be responding in crazy ways to things that are completely crazy. And you know, to me, it's not normal when people manage to how can you stay sane in a world that is completely crazy? Anyways, so that question that we had, I think that fits really well right now about how this healing work is connected to the broader work of our communities. Fran?
Well, I wanted to make sure and mention that as far as the Aboriginal people are concerned, that the Aboriginal people of Canada have suffered for generations because of the Government of Canada's policy of extinguishment, which is aimed to diminish our identity and self-worth. This particular form of genocide is not to kill us off physically, but to take away our souls and spirit and leave the body standing. This type of cultural genocide perpetuates self-hate, and we become homicidal and suicidal. We start killing each other and committing suicide because of the unresolved issues of sexual, physical, spiritual, and mental abuse. Just being born Aboriginal exposes us to this type of genocide. And also talking about being irrational versus rational. Being irrational, emotional is being just being human, being a human being. Like, I don't agree with rational and structured therapy and all that. It has to be a natural process. And I guess one of the the good things about healing on the First Nation is that we have that connection to the environment that few people would have in the city. And that's one of the good things that we have there, that open space, that connection, the importance of the spirit and the emotion.
How about Michelle? Could you talk a little bit about how your work with people who have survived torture, how that experience relates to other struggles that they may be facing in their community?
Other struggles? I think the big struggle is being believed. The immigration or the refugee regulations on paper says that, and status. As far as I know, because I'm not a lawyer, but the refugee regulations, in writing, it's supposed to be benefit of the doubt. And in actual practice, it's default disbelief. I mean, so we have people coming, fleeing terrible situations with terrible experiences, and they have to explain themselves at the border to people who don't believe them. They have to explain themselves to the lawyers who have seen too much and dealt with too much. They have to explain themselves to other service providers who themselves have burnt out. And they have to explain themselves to everybody, And the default is disbelief. And the consequence of that is, people don't want to talk about it. And they don't talk about it because they don't feel believed and they don't feel supported. So then, of course, in the larger community, if you have this denial and disbelief, how can you acknowledge that it exists? And then if you don't acknowledge that it exists, how do you address it and how do you deal with it? So I think, that the very fact that we're here and we deal with the people that we deal with is very important to the larger Canadian community and international community, that torture is practiced in 2/3 of the countries of the world. I mean, this is not abnormal behavior. This is normal behavior in a number of countries. And normal, not in the sense it's right, it's every day. And recognizing that this exists and accepting the truth of it obligates us to do something. It obligates us to take a stand in whatever capacity we can, that this is, aside from it being illegal, it's cruel and it's immoral behavior.
And do we not have experiences of torture here in Canada and the United States?
Can you honestly say that no torture happens? Well, I don't think so.
Aren't we discussing this right now as a regular kind of news item?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's this really despicable article in the Globe and Mail about the possibilities of having a form of legalized torture written by Alan Dershowitz about, possibility of torturing somebody to get information. And, people who make those arguments never really reflect on how that changes the person or the community that is doing the torturing. It's always assumed that it's going to be a consequence-free activity, that you only torture the bad guys and they deserved it anyway. And there's never any acknowledgement of the internalization of that kind of violence in the perpetrator, who then goes home and, plays with his children and, I would love to say beats his wife, but we can't say that because you can't make that connection. If a society accepts any kind of torture, or even in very limited terms, if the society finds that acceptable, then other abuses are also going to be acceptable. These things don't happen in a vacuum. And so if you want to address violence and abuse, you also have to address it at that end, that you don't torture nasty people.
Well, that's what happened to the children that were sent to the residential schools. They were tortured, they were experimented on, and they were conditioned not to be native.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened here in Canada. People have to realize that and recognize that. And that's what we're dealing with on the First Nations.
I think it also has had a big effect on Canadian society in two ways. One, for those who believe and accept the reality, there's a lot of reflection going on. And, a commitment not to perpetuate or to continue doing that. But and also I've noticed that there's quite a lot of denial in other communities, and you hear a certain tone in people's voice when they talk about Aboriginals and residential school systems. So you have these opposing viewpoints, which creates tension in the society, which I think should exist. You know, you have to always have that discourse.
I want to remind listeners that you can call in. The number is 416-595-1655. You're listening to Special International Women's Day programming on CKLN 88.1.
And we've only got about 15 minutes left of this show, so please call soon if you really got something to say or a question that you want to ask. I wanted to ask a question of our panelists in terms of all of you are engaged with, you know, people who all of you are engaged with sort of helping or supporting people who are, as they say, going through a hard time, people who have experienced a lot of emotionally traumatizing things in their lives. And also people who have been at times re-victimized when they've gone to look for help. And I wanted to ask you, as women who are hearing these stories on a daily basis, how do you take care of yourselves? How do you deal with the sort of vicarious trauma that you can experience?
I just wanted to, with that question, doing this work with Rosalie for a long time, I've been able to deal with a lot of my issues and emotional pain. And what develops with this type of holistic therapy is that we develop a detached awareness where we don't get triggered by the clients. And so that's one of the good things, one of the benefits of working on myself as well as assisting clients and understanding their survivors and understanding their pain, because I've gone through it myself.
Again, you know, it's on two levels, because service providers have a different thing than volunteers. Service providers, you know, try to maintain this professional distance, but sometimes it doesn't always work. Sometimes you get hit with stories that are so bad that there's just no defense. So then there are self-care things that you do. You know, one of the things we do in our office when there's a traumatic event is you end up visiting each other a lot and debriefing and sitting down and sharing feelings. We're also trying somewhat formal stress management activities such as yoga. and other things. We do social events with the group, and quite a few parties happen at our center, and potlucks and things like that. So, and also, you know, maintaining a sense of humor as much as you can in some circumstances. Laughing is very important.
And that's what I wanted to mention as well, is that, I mean, I do a lot of self-care because I have to. Mm-hmm. And I as a professional, like, I don't really think of myself as a professional. I think of myself as a person, and I don't put myself above my, you know, the rest of the clients or the survivors. I'm just like them. Mm-hmm. And we have that in common, so there's no hierarchy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, and there's that equality amongst all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that also is at CCBT, because quite a few of our counselors have had similar experiences in their own histories. So it's, you know, aside from the normal vicarious traumatization that one would experience, there's always the experience of being re-traumatized, and I've seen that happen, and it's very difficult.
I think that if you deal with those deep, that deep emotional issues or pain, then you won't get re-traumatized. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that because of the work I've done and what I've seen, and you know, if you're able to deal with those core issues, mm-hmm. because society, they just focus on the surface. We go right to the core.
Mm-hmm.
And once you deal with them, and if you can talk about a an experience without emotion, then you've dealt with it. You've dealt with your issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you can talk about it without emotion.
Oh, I don't know if I totally agree with that. Do you need to take a break?
No.
No, go ahead. I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of interesting, like this discussion of dealing with core issues and getting through. I don't know if you can actually ever really get through core issues. I think you can peel layers of the onion and get to a place where you have more understanding. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know how. I don't know if I can answer that for myself. If there's ever really a resolving of life. But I'm just coming out of a bout of burnout, actually, because, well, I guess I was stupid and I didn't take care of myself enough as much as I should have. And partially that's because I really work hard at not having professional distance or any distance, and because I identify so much with people that I hang out with. And in fact, I choose as much as I can not to have a professional relationship with anyone while making money in a world where it really emphasizes that you have to be quote unquote professional. So I'm sort of leading a kind of facade because I want to make money, because I want to buy things, and I have to get into a role in order to get that money. But when I hang out with people who are quote unquote messed up, it becomes a strange kind of landscape to navigate, the fact that I get money, that often they don't get money, and they have some hardcore stories, and some of them, I you know, they just have stories, I have stories, and it kind of got a little bit overwhelming to navigate all of that. So I guess I got pooped, and instead of going to the psychiatric hospital because the service isn't so good there for me, I went to a bed and breakfast, and I felt better. But I'm pretty tired, but whatever, life goes on.
I just wanted to say that what I talk about is actually happening and going on, and we're finding success with this. And you know, if you don't know anything about it, then you don't. And I'm telling you, this, it works, or I wouldn't be here. We're seeing success with our survivors, our clients, mm-hmm. and like I said, we go right to the core.
What do you define as success?
That they move through those four stages of healing. They deal with their victim pain, they deal with their emotional, their abuser pain, and their body changes, the mental is enhanced, the physical, the spiritual, all parts of them are enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you can say whatever you want, but you don't know anything about it, and it's working.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know, I'd like to talk to you more about it, and we only have 10 minutes left, but I think it's I'm still navigating like how you're talking about whatever it is you're talking about. You're right, I don't understand what you're talking about, because you're using language that sounds very medical model to me. And when you categorize things in stages and levels,
it's not medical model, it's holistic.
Yeah, I believe you. Yeah,
It's about the spirit and the emotion, and I could get into that, but it would take hours.
Yeah.
I do a workshop that takes 2 days.
It sounds like you're talking about, what we talked about in the beginning, how a person integrates his or her experiences into their life. So it becomes not an other, it becomes...
It's about going back into those experiences and bringing those pieces back to you, back to self, that you've left in those trauma situations. So it's
so
pretty deep.
Discovering yourself.
Yeah.
Whatever the self is.
Well, that's yours to discover.
Well, we have a good idea of, you know, what's working with Aboriginal people, and it's working with us.
Mm-hmm. I think you, Aboriginal people, have one big advantage over, for example, refugees, and that is whatever has happened, at least you still have your sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that has never been really taken away.
We know who we are, and we're still connected to the ancestors, ancestors, you know, that are on the other side, or in heaven, whatever mainstream calls it, we're connected, yeah, and we always
that,
will
that
be.
That was never disconnected no, for it wasn't. You, so that's and we have very that important. Yeah.
Well, we can see that there's a lot of different ways of thinking about these concepts, and they're difficult concepts to grapple with.
One thing that I was thinking about earlier was when Michelle and was speaking about refugees coming to Canada and needing to make their claim, you know, to claim their suffering, to get status here as refugees. They're sort of people who need to do that are forced to go to the medical system to have their suffering sort of validated, you know, and it's just another way that a certain way of understanding those things is kind of forced on people.
But when I look at our statistics, though, in terms of the total numbers, like if you compare us to, for example, there's a rehabilitation center in London, England, and they are medical. They have a medical model, and I think if I'm not mistaken, they see between 30 and 50 clients per year, and it's medical psychiatric therapy treatment. And we see last year we saw well over 1,100 people, and of those 1,100, I maybe between 20 and 25% actually only ever accessed medical or psychiatric services. So yeah, I mean it's there for people who need it, but it's not a given. You know, it's not just because you have been tortured or you have experienced severe trauma, it doesn't mean you have to go trot off to the nearest psychologist. You know, that's something that's up to you, I think, and given your own experiences of the system.
I think we're going to have to wrap this up really soon. So I wanted to ask if anybody had something final that they wanted to say, and Audrey would like to close with a poem, I believe. And I'd like to play a reading that was done at a recent tribute to Audre Lorde. And so that's how we're going to spend the last 5 minutes of this show. I want to thank the people who've called in as well. But anybody like to make any final comments?
Not really. I found this very powerful, and I'm glad I did it.
I just wanted to say that, this was a very good conversation, and that I'm realizing, or what's being affirmed for me yet again, is how different oppressions are kept separate from each other, and that we don't communicate together enough, and we kind of stay within our separate groups, dealing with our separate oppressions, and really I think we need to get together.
What I wanted to say was that I live in I don't live in the city, I live in the First Nation, and I see the pain every day that the people carry, and that's what I'm dedicated to, because I was there where they're at, and I want to help and support them, and we know what we need to heal, and that's the other message I wanted to send out there, and we're helping each other.
I just want to read a poem by Christos. Christos is a Menominee poet. She is a psych survivor. She was psychiatrized because she talked about the sexual abuse that her uncle was perpetrating on her that made her crazy. So she was thrown into the nut house and she was forced sterilized. She went through a lot. She's an amazing poet and talks about how this writing has been has saved her life. And I'm going to read a poem called "We Cut Off Our Hair as Our Children Kill Themselves at 14 or 17 in mass explosions, one after another, until 10 or 23 are dead, on one reservation after another, multiplied across our land. Breathing this colonized air, they take poison into their hearts, listening for the message of genocide, so much easier when we do it to ourselves and save whites the trouble. Grief cuts out our hearts and laughs, din of this cruel survival, breath to breath. Going on through this pain we know strips us, crushes us beneath bulldozers and booze. We pray for you, our children. Live. Become the river of our continuing hoop. Live. Become the breath of our never silent drums. Live. Become the future read and remembered. Live. Become our voices singing up the sun. Live.
I want to thank all of our guests, Fran Tababandong, Lucy Costa, Michelle Millard, and of course, Audrey Huntley, who's been co-hosting this panel discussion tonight, and Deborah Hayes, our very able technician, who came in specially to do this. I just wanted to close with a reading from the poetry of Audre Lorde, who was a strong Black lesbian poet, feminist, mother, and warrior, who passed away 11 years ago of cancer. Just a couple weeks ago, the Toronto Women's Bookstore organized a tribute to her and a screening of a new film called The Edge of Each Other's Battles, The Life and Vision of Audre Lorde. This excerpt is from the Cancer Journals. It's called The Transformation of Silence into Language and Action, read by Robin Byers, a local Toronto activist and educator. She noted that reading Audre Lorde's The Cancer Journals helped her to understand her own experience of losing her mother to breast cancer. So I just wanted to outro with that and thank everybody who has been listening. You are listening to CKLN 88.1 FM, International Women's Day programming.
In becoming forcibly and essentially aware of my mortality and of what I wished and wanted for my life, however short it might be, priorities and omissions became strongly etched in a merciless light, and what I most regretted were my silences. Of what had I ever been afraid? To question or to speak as I believed could have meant pain or death. But we all hurt in so many different ways, all the time, and pain will either change or end. Death, on the other hand, is the final silence. And that might be coming quickly now, without regard for whether I had ever spoken what needed to be said, or had only betrayed myself in small silences, while I planned someday to speak, or waited for someone else's words. And I began to recognize a source of power within myself that comes from the knowledge that while it is most desirable not to be afraid, learning to put fear into perspective gave me great strength. I was going to die, if not sooner, then later, whether or not I had ever spoken myself. My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you. But for every real word spoken, for every attempt I had ever made to speak those truths for which I am still seeking, I have made contact with other women while we examined the words to fit a world in which we all believed, bridging our differences. And it was the concern and caring of all those women which gave me my strength and enabled me to scrutinize the essentials of my living. The women who sustained me through that period were Black and white, old and young, lesbian, bisexual, and heterosexual, and we all shared a war against the tyrannies of silence. They all gave me a strength and concern without which I could not have survived intact. Within those weeks of acute fear came the knowledge. Within the war, we are all waging with the forces of death, subtle and otherwise, conscious or not. I am not only a casualty, I am also a warrior. What are the words you do not yet have? What do you need to say? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them still in silence? Perhaps for some of you here today, I am the face of one of your fears because I am a woman, because I am Black, because I am a lesbian, because I am myself, a Black woman, warrior, poet doing my work, come to ask you, are you doing yours? And of course, I am afraid. You can hear it in my voice, because the transformation of silence into language and action is an act of self-revelation, and that always seems fraught with danger. In the cause of silence, each one of us draws the face of her own fear, fear of contempt, of censure, of some judgment or recognition, of challenge, of annihilation. Of most of all, I think, we fear the very visibility without which we can not truly live. Within this country where racial difference creates a constant, if unspoken, distortion of vision, Black women have on one hand always been highly visible, and so on the other hand have been rendered invisible through the depersonalization of racism. Even within the women's movement, we have had to fight, and still do, for that very visibility which also renders us most vulnerable, our Blackness. For to survive in the mouth of this dragon we call America, we have had to learn this first and most vital lesson, that we were never meant to survive, not as human beings. And neither were most of you here today, Black or not. And the visibility which makes us most vulnerable is that which also is the source of our greatest strength. Because the machine will try to grind you into dust anyway, whether or not we speak. We can sit in our corners mute forever while our sisters and ourselves are wasted, while our children are distorted, while our children are destroyed, while our earth is poisoned. We can sit in our safe corners mute as bottles, and we still will be no less afraid. The fact that we are here and that I speak now these words is an attempt to break that silence and bridge some of those differences between us. For it is not difference which immobilizes us, but silence. And there are so many silences to be broken.